Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Attention deficit disorder and its less common near relative attention deficit disorder. Hyperactivity disorder affect more than the person who is diagnosed with a neurological condition. Everyone around them, from family, loved ones, work associates, teachers, coaches, you name it, have a stake in helping them on the journey. And that's how licensed psychologist Wes Crenshaw and Dr. Kelsey Doherty approached their latest book on the topic. It's titled ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD is for anyone who wants to know more about and understand how to manage ADD. Wes Crenshaw is with us. So, by the way, listeners, bring your questions, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Wes Crenshaw, welcome back.
It's nice to be here. It's always nice to say to the host, this is my favorite show. But I mean it. This is really one of my favorite public radio shows to do.
Well, and it's been, you know, ironically, I think there's certainly a question in our conversation today about the impact of the pandemic. And I've wanted to talk to you all year long about what this is doing to people who are on this journey this past year. And we will talk about that. But for starters, I wanted to do sort of our little thumbnails on what is ADD versus ADHD and how common are they?
Yeah, so I always say that ADHD, the rebranding of that in about DSM-3 from ADD to ADHD is kind of a mess because the majority of people who have this disorder do not have hyperactivity.
Right.
Yet we are required to call it that. And so it's like going into the pizza joint and asking for a cheese pizza without the cheese.
Right.
And it's confusing for people because they'll look at their kid and they'll say, well, you know, he isn't hyperactive. That's the minority of people. And if there is hyperactivity, it presents itself, you know, like restlessness and irritability. It's the rare kid who's what we think of as hyper, bouncing off the walls, driven by a motor.
Right. And the attention deficit disorder, you're right. That is the stereotype that we associate with it, the hyperactivity. But actually, it can be the very quiet child in the corner.
Yes. This is what we refer to as internally focused. So, and it's weird because this isn't really in the book. It's taken me a while to realize how true this is. But we will get people who are externally focus. So they have distractibility outside, you know, the squirrel joke, you know, how many kids does it take to tune a light bulb? Look, a squirrel. That's the externally focused people. But there's a whole lot of people who are internally distracted. And these are kids who really have an internal world that's much more interesting, you know, imagine that, than the outside world. And they become easily distracted without any what we call extraneous stimulus. So we have to really, you know, see those two sides of it.
And I see different numbers. I know that there's the diagnoses out there and we can point to those numbers. They're pretty concrete. But what's the sense about how common ADD is?
Well, it's become more common in the last 15 to 20 years. And there's all sorts of lay people and some not lay people, some in the field arguing about what that's about. One thing listeners really should embrace is that this is not overdiagnosed. Overdiagnosis is not a thing. You would have to really know that there are, you know, 20 million ADD people in the world who really are ADD and then find out that 27 million were diagnosed. And we just don't know that. We know that there are people who haven't been diagnosed that need to be, and we know there are people who are diagnosed who shouldn't be. And the real issue is bad diagnosis. So really figuring out who has it and who doesn't in the population is harder to do than we make it sound like sometimes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about ADD / ADHD today with Wes Crenshaw, licensed psychologist and co-author of the new book, ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. If you have a question or comment coming up, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we sort of talked about the stereotype of the hyperactivity piece of it, but there is also, besides that, a stigma associated with this. You talk about that and how parents respond when you're talking about medicating their children.
Yeah, one of the problems with the stigma is that people see it as kind of faith-based almost, like, do you believe in ADD or do you not believe in ADD? And this is sort of odd. No one says, I don't believe in depression, unless they're sort of joking. But we have a big controversy
about this. It used to be questioned.
Well,
more.
Yeah, we have a history going back to beyond Lincoln. You know, Lincoln was thought to have melancholy. And so we have a long history with accepting depression. And we don't have a problem with autism. You know, we don't go around telling people you're not autistic. But it is popular to tell people they're not ADHD. And sometimes that comes from the parent who doesn't want to believe it, or quite commonly because it's hereditary, doesn't want to see it in themselves. So they don't want to see it in their kids. And so people will sort of be in denial about it. And that makes, whether it's intended to stigmatize or not, it does make folks who have legitimate ADHD feel ostracized, feel misunderstood, even from a very early age.
And it can also affect treatment going forward, because it's helpful to know if your aunt or your uncle or your mom or your dad or an older brother or somebody shares the diagnosis.
Very helpful, because one of the things we know with great certainty is that the actual ADHD comes from often from heredity. And there are some factors that improve or make worse your condition. We talk about in the book the diathesis stress model. But the predisposition for ADD is typically hereditary. And people are like, well, you know, my grandfather did fine and I'm doing fine. Why does my kid need this? The world, I don't know if you've noticed this in your work, Ian, but the world's gotten a little more complicated in our lifetimes. And so it's harder now for someone who has trouble focusing and directing their attention, choosing what they want to focus on. It's harder for them to do well in a high-tech world. You can't just, if you're working in a factory, you're often running machines. Most of my guys that work in factories are technicians. They fix the machines. So these are much more skilled, focused, educated labor force now. And that's harder when you have ADHD. So it shows up more in the population now.
When I was reading that in your book, and that issue of a changing world, and then how ADHD and ADD present in this changing world, how that changes, it made me think about people who maybe were illiterate, couldn't read.
Right.
For a long time, you could get by. I mean, and people did. And it was difficult and stressful, probably, and all kinds of pathology associated with that. Be that as it may, you could get by. And now, not so much anymore.
That's a good analogy. I may steal that from you, because it's spot on. If you don't need to read and you just need to forge weapons in a blacksmith shop, mm-hmm. or something, or forge whatever you're going to make in a blacksmith shop, you don't spend time learning to read. And now that reading is important, we all assume it's an essential, and almost every job you do is going to have some reading requirement. Likewise with ADHD, it's harder now to do things you can't focus on than it would have been 50 years ago.
You titled the book ADD and Zombies. And they're, you know, why zombies? From reading it, I think I know, but tell me.
Yeah. Well, so admittedly, that's a little jokey, but it comes from a phenomenon we call the zombie effect. And it's a complicated phenomenon. Where you hear this is typically amongst teenage boys and young adult men. And they come in and you say, so, you know, you've been assessed for ADD. How's your medicine working? Well, I don't take it. That's my teenage boy impression. And it comes from years of study. And you say, well, gosh, why don't you take it? Well, I don't know. I don't like how it makes me feel. And you say, well, what's wrong with it? Well, it makes me feel like a zombie. And some version of this is you then say, well, what does it mean to, you know, feel like a zombie? Well, I'll just take it and all they want to do is read a book. And we say, well, that's called studying. So there is a phenomenological experience of this that particularly young men in our society do not associate with success and being better. And they associate that with being zombified, being like this kind of, you know, sad-eyed person marching through the structured world. And they don't like that.
And so, all right, let's see, quote-unquote normal. would be someone who can both feel like an individual and all the creativity and the spontaneity of that and also read a book.
Well, right. And this is the part where they're not, the part that's not just their personal experience is the purpose of the medicines for ADHD. And, you know, I'm not a prescriber, but mm-hmm. I employ them. The purpose of medicines for ADHD is to make you more serious. I mean, it to make you focus, to make you care more, as we say in the book. And if what you like is being spontaneous and funny and cutting up and playing a video game real cool and all that stuff, then you may not associate what medicine does with something you like. But it is true. And when parents say, well, I don't like what it does to their personality, you know, that's not just a false impression. There is a change. What we try to get clients to think about is there's fun, spontaneous time, and there is studious, focused time. And you got to have both in your life. That sometimes is a difficult conversion, but it happens. And there is a difference, honestly, a gender difference. Young women in our society are taught to be the driven force, to get up and, you know, nobody's going to give you anything. You're going to have to earn it for yourself. This has been the daughters of feminism. They see that they have to do for themselves. And they are much more tolerant of those feelings of studying the book than a lot of the young men are. It's an interesting gender link.
It's an unfortunate one because young men are affected by this more than females.
Well, and affected in both uses of the word. They are the more diagnosed, but they are also the more impacted.
So. In the book and in your previous one, I always want to be where I'm not, successful living with ADD and ADHD. You say that medication for this condition is vital, but you also say that the search for medication is what often gets people off track on that. How so?
Well, we've become so focused on getting on medicine for ADD. That's just like an automatic sentence. Mm-hmm. In one sense, that is good in that people understand the value of that, and there is value in it. But then that means you, of course, go to your physician and the guy that gives you, helps you with your throat infection and request that medicine. And there are kind of two or three physicians that you will see. One will say, no, I don't do that. You'll abuse it, which isn't totally a myth, but it is an overstatement of what happens. Then there's the physician who's like, oh, sure, no problem, and never do a thorough evaluation and just go right down that road. And then once in a while, you'll get somebody who has some experience with it. But all of those folks, and, you know, I love my physician. I see them as clients. Mm-hmm. I like them a great deal. But all of them have one thing in common, and it's unfortunately in common even with psychiatrists. They're not really paid to spend time with you and to talk to you and to hear about your life. You get your, 7 minutes or 15 minutes, and they make an assessment. This is where the idea of overdiagnosis comes from, that it's too easy to get that diagnosis, and that usually starts people off in the wrong direction.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour is Wes Crenshaw. He's a licensed psychologist. He's co-author of a new book, ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. These days, we throw around the terms of ADD and ADHD like we know what we're talking about. Even the experts still grapple with the manifestations of attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They mean different things to different people. They feel different in different people. And the medications, therapy, and other strategies for living with the more common ADD especially are different for different people. But that doesn't mean success in life isn't in the cards for any of them. Still with us is psychologist Wes Crenshaw. His new book, co-authored with Dr. Kelsey Doherty, is titled ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right, you brought it up. You kind of touched upon it. Training is a big issue for both pediatricians because that's most times it's children present around 5 or 6 years old, and psychiatrists who treat adults. Why is training so hard to come by? This has been around for a long time.
Well, it's first of all, pediatricians vary, just like the example I gave, in how comfortable they feel doing this. And I think some of them feel not comfortable at all. There's an article in Attitude Magazine from a few years ago that really discussed how minimal the training is in working with stimulant medication. And it's a unique kind of medication. It's something we really have to, as therapists, coach clients on how to operate. We have an endless amount of this in the book. How do you work stimulant medication? It's not just pop the pill in the morning and be done with it. So that it's not just the training, though that's a big part of it. It's that inability to be paid to really spend time with the client. And when you've, you know, I've been at this for 28 years now. I've had tens of thousands of hours of conversations with clients, and you build kind of a database. So that is training in and of itself. And if you can't do that and be reimbursed in our medical system for that, you just never build up that intuitive sense, that sort of Malcolm Gladwell blink expertise in that work, if you're not going to be able to have those kind of conversations.
And so then we come to the issue of finding the right person to help you. I mean, finding the right pediatrician, finding the right psychiatrist, finding the right psychologist.
What we like to encourage people to do is to try and start with a mental health provider, like a psychologist or a therapist. Depends on in each state what your licensure laws are like, who can do that. Psychologists always can. In some states, social workers, licensed counselors. And go to somebody who expresses on their website or in their credentials that they've done this work a lot. And we like to have those people be comfortable in working with medication providers, preferably in the same office like we do it, but more commonly just have a referral for that. So you start there and get a good evaluation, and that goes way beyond the checklist. There's a thing called the Vanderbilt, which is a fine checklist, but all it really is the DSM-5 with little boxes next to the criteria. What we like to see is a norm reference test, which means it compares you to people of your age and gender. The Connors is an example. There's also a couple others. Barclay has one. And so that way we know how, if you deviate from the norm group, sounds terrible, doesn't it? But if how different are you from the norm in your ADD? And that's what makes the diagnosis. So you go there first, and hopefully they have a referral to someone who does prescription. That might be a psychiatrist, but there aren't a ton of those left in the world.
That's for sure.
That's a diminishing species there. And more commonly, psychiatric nurse practitioners. Ohio has an independent practice law for that. And then folks can get in and see them a little bit more readily. And the schools are churning out more nurse practitioners now. So I think that's going to help solve some of the prescription problem we've seen in the last few years.
I'm going to turn to some callers right now. Arlen in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Arlen.
Hey, Ann. I have a question for your caller. I have both I had for a long time undiagnosed sleep apnea, but for my entire childhood, I've been diagnosed with having attention deficit disorder. I wonder, in some specific cases, not in all, obviously, is ADD for those people who have undiagnosed sleep apnea a symptom of the sleep apnea instead of actually the problem in of itself?
Interesting.
Because if you look at the effects of sleep apnea and the conditions of attention deficit disorder, there is a astonishing amounts of overlap. specific circumstances, has there been any case study to realize that maybe for some people, if that's the case, they need to have their sleep apnea treated, and they don't have attention deficit disorder per se, as that's, in this case, it's a symptom.
It's interesting.
I'll take my call off you.
Yeah, Arlen, thank you so much. Yeah.
That's a great question, yeah. And Arlen is spot on. So as a person who is quite enthralled with his CPAP, I can tell you, I have a little travel one that's with me right now. I can tell you that is a real thing. And we have made multiple referrals from our clinic for sleep studies because we were concerned about that. So one of the things, you know, when I said you go in for a good evaluation, that's on the list of things people should address in their evaluation session with the therapist or psychologist. And if sleep is abnormal for any reason, then you want to study that and perhaps get a sleep study. Here are the 57 catches. This is a show in and of itself. I'll get to like one or two of them. At the top of the list, there's a thing in the book I refer to as ADD-related insomnia. Both of my kids have that. And it's interesting that this is not in the DSM because other disorders like depression, we associate with sleep problems too much, too little. For some folks, lots of folks with ADHD, their mind doesn't shut off at night, and so they don't sleep well. So that while that in that example wouldn't be sleep apnea, it both results from the ADHD and contributes to it. And I go through this nauseatingly long list of things you can do to improve your sleep, which clients hate. They don't want to have that conversation. They yell at me. They cry.
Sounds like work.
They don't like it. But if all else fails, sometimes that has to be treated in tandem with the ADHD. And if you – let me tell you, and of course, as if that weren't troublesome enough, stimulant medication can, for some people, make insomnia worse. Mm. So all of that's the long answer to say, yes, if you have sleep apnea – or think you may have sleep apnea, you want to treat that before you do stimulant medication for a lot of reasons.
Change the baseline then.
Right.
Yeah, right. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about ADD and ADHD, medication management for that. And medication management also includes therapy. In the opinion of Wes Crenshaw, licensed psychologist and co-author of a new book, it's titled ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, you've kind of touched on the diagnosis process for ADD or ADHD. And, you know, there's some real quick, you know, questionnaires that people can sign off on. But the more thorough process is lengthy questionnaires, really lengthy questionnaires, and also some that are filled out by maybe a teacher or maybe a coach or a mom or a dad or a caretaker, a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a partner, and yourself.
Yeah. Before we give anyone that diagnosis, we use the Conners and we send them to the, it's all done electronically, but we send out the link to the individual and then also to, if they're an adult, to their dating partner, maybe their parent, if the parent knows them well. And we try to find people who aren't biased against the disorder to begin with, because we don't want people to do a reverse halo effect or a halo effect where they either overscore or underscore the person. And then we look at all that data. And the hard, as you can well imagine, the most frustrating part of this is for high school kids, getting a teacher to do one of those accurately is just like pulling teeth. For elementary school kids, the teachers know those kids pretty well.
Yes.
And middle school, back and forth. My wife was a middle school teacher, and she was great at doing this for her kids because she knew the instrument. But for some other teachers in middle school, they don't know the kids as well. But by high school, that gets really difficult. In college, unless you're in a very small liberal arts college, your teachers aren't going to know you very well, which is unfortunate because they're good reporters when you can get the data. But we hit all those points. Then we also, you know, the fundamental question if you're an adult and have ADHD that the therapist or psychologist should be asking is, how come you didn't get this diagnosed a long time ago? And that's not us being tricky. We're just trying to figure out what went wrong, because we have as a goal to separate the people who need to be on medicine from the people who don't. And there may be great reasons why you didn't get it diagnosed when you were 16 or 13 or 12. But we want to know what those are so we can pick out the people who need, you know, a sleep study, mm-hmm. Have had some other issue that may look like ADHD, or you'll get those people who are just stimulant seeking. We don't want to be a part of that process.
Right. Right. Gotcha. The Adderall
situation.
Let's turn to now Nancy in Granville. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. This is so interesting to me in so many ways. Because I know it's in my family, and I'm a retired teacher, and I have filled out those horrible questionnaires.
Hey, you. Don't pick on my questionnaires.
Well, I was an elementary teacher during most of my career, so I really put my time, but of course didn't get paid for it. But anyway, my comment is, I remember when I was learning to be a teacher, and we came upon the topic of the divergent thinker. Hmm. And it was kind of viewed as something that was not so good. But in my mind, I'm sitting there and I'm feeling like, oh, yeah, I'm one of those. Whenever a topic comes up, my mind shoots off in all these different directions that are related to me, that I, you know, that's kind of how your brain works. But I kind of viewed it as, I mean, I'm not saying I'm real intelligent, but I think that children, over the years, I've noticed that these children who do this are really up there in their ability to achieve. And yet in the classroom, it's not going to show up, you know, the way that you typically do. So I'm wondering if, for one thing, is it related to intelligence in any way? And does it also show up with depression and anxiety? Does it lead to that?
Does it lead to it, or is it part of it? Yeah, comorbidity. Yeah.
So let's split that into two sections, because I know where she's headed on the second half, and it's an interesting question. In terms of performance, in I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, the book, I each of the chapters, I have a little section on, you know, what's good about having ADD, and there are things that are good. I'll give you but one example, and there are many. I have, for whatever reason, I hired all the ADHD people in Kansas to work for me. I don't know how that happened, but they found me. And one of the things they're really good at is making sure our workflow is efficient. Because they hate redundancy, they hate doing things that are detail-oriented and all this. While that sounds super annoying, the reality is they're very helpful in making my workflow as easy as it can be.
Okay, so you're saying you hired all the ADD, you mean people with ADD?
No, literally.
Yeah, okay.
They can't hear us now because they're in Kansas. No, some of them are treated for it. I don't know what the therapist world has come to, but I have 12 staff and half of them have ADHD. That was never planned. But they do great work if I make their universe efficient. And so they are like, if you want to hire an efficiency expert, seriously, go hire someone who's got ADHD, and they will tell you everything wrong. My daughter, being a good example, is on this trip with me. She can find everything wrong in everything because she wants to find the smoothest path forward, not the lazy path, the smooth path. So that's an example of something they think differently.
There's a certain logic there.
Yes, and they see things differently. And there's a bunch of those examples in the first book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, the teacher in the call also points out, sort of, I'm going to say it differently than she did, but there's all this tremendous potential, and yet when it comes to book learning to school, even vocational training sometimes, they have a really hard time. And that is the truth. So the secret of all treatment for ADHD, here comes the secret, is you want to try to maximize that potential and not turn people into someone they're not. This whole zombie effect idea is help people become more fully who they are. And if you can get folks wrapped around that, and we have very high, you know, in the biz, this is called treatment compliance. It sounds very fascist, and it's not meant to, is people who want to adhere to the treatment protocol. We have really high numbers on that. People do follow through on our treatment plans at the office because we want them to feel like partners in this process and that they are going to become more fully who they are instead of subjugated, you know, zombified. So the second thing she brings up is the depression and anxiety thing. And and the way she phrased that, I think, is good because let me tell you what. ADHD, as it stands, I say in the book, if you're not if you have ADHD and you're not depressed, you don't really understand your situation very well, because it is very painful to be not able to connect the way your peers can, the way your family members can, with the world, and to be a participant in that. There's also this question of anxiety, and there tends to be, not always, but there's a fairly high correlation between ADHD and anxiety. And if you go into your primary care physician or a pediatrician, they're going to catch one of those things. They're going to see the ADHD or they're going to see the anxiety. And the problem, as we go into lots of detail in the book, is if you treat one of those and not the other, you're going to make one worse. You're going to make the person more anxious if you treat them with stimulants, or you're going to make the person more lackadaisical if you treat them with an SSRI. So this is why we're successful at this, is because we look at this as a complicated puzzle.
Holistically.
Holistically, yes.
Nancy, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate it. 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And here's something I think related. It's Chris in Clintonville. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Can you turn down your radio?
My radio is off. I've got you on speakerphone.
I'll gotcha. That'd be good. Take that off. Yeah. Hi, Chris.
Technology. Thank you very much for this show. I think it's really important, Mr. Crenshaw. I really appreciate your work. I wanted to ask, in a society where we have through our educational system and our kind of social environment, kind of stigmatized blue-collar jobs. We've taken all of the industrial arts opportunities out of the standard educational curriculum. Whether we have removed a lot of kind of appropriate channels for those people who would be better off in life being a machinist. We're not a nation of makers anymore, and the consequence is the people who have these God-given gifts are somewhat odd fish in a nation where, sit-down jobs are valued more so than industrial jobs, which might be just a better fit for people with these personality types. So I really appreciated your emphasis on helping people be successful in life, and wanted you to speak to this, how maybe the kind of our social contract from the educational system is kind of creating a real disservice to our society with this, if you could talk to that.
100% with you. My undergraduate degrees are actually in political science, sociology, and history. So I think this way naturally and think of this larger system picture. I also come from the home of the University of Kansas. So I'm in Lawrence, Kansas. And so we are overly enthralled in Lawrence with this idea of all the kids need to go to Yale. And, they must go and do this march towards towards college. Fortunately, in the last 7 or 8 years, we've begun to renew our desire to be involved in vocational and technical training, and that is a nationwide trend. We were slow on the uptick. So I think we are headed back in that direction. We talk about this in the book quite a bit. What we try to do, and I have this conversation like 5 days a week, as do my staff, with parents who have maybe lofty goals that they want their child to, either go to Vassar or act like they've been to Vassar. And in reality, what they want to do is a vocation. And trades are a fine place to be right now. Welding, electrician,
HVAC. There's a high demand and they pay well.
Absolutely. What more do you want? And whereas some professions that require 4, 5, 6, 7 years of college and grad school are not as successful or as auspicious. So I completely agree, not just for folks with ADHD, but everyone. The goal, and you said it again, the goal is to not force fit people into the box that we think they should be in. It's to liberate them through treatment to be who they aspire to be.
Chris, thank you for that call. We have other calls. We have emails. I want to get to as many as possible. We'll be right back with Wes Cronshaw, licensed psychologist and co-author of the new book, ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to manage attention deficit disorder today. In his new book, co-authored with Dr. Kelsey Doherty, licensed psychologist Wes Cronshaw posits that any successful treatment will involve medication and therapy. The book is titled ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. Wes Cronshaw is still with us. We have calls, and I kind of want to get right to them. But before we do, I want to get to an email from Nell, who says, "Hi, I am barely out of my 20s, and I don't recall a single student in my elementary or high school back in Africa having a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD because corporal punishment was allowed and all the students were well-behaved, quiet, and followed instructions and structure. How much of this diagnosis is cultural?" So there's a lot going on in that, Wes.
So what you're describing there is a more distant past in the United States also. And certain schools, boarding schools, religious schools, often still do have some of those same frameworks. The problem is that there's a bit of a cognitive fallacy in that explanation. Having ADHD is not the absence of being able to follow rules. That's somewhat too much a stereotype of the hyperactive child, which those do exist. And I don't have any problem with being strict in classrooms and having rules. That's probably a good idea, and it works well for the ADHD folks. But the problem is it's an internal process. It's the inability to focus, and I usually use a driving metaphor for this. You know, when you're driving down the road, most of us have driven, you don't just stare at the white line and that's focus. If you stare at the white line, you're going to have a wreck, you know. So what you do instead is you take in all this data. You think about the pedestrian walking across the street and the red light and the green light. And do I turn left here? I did, in fact, get lost on the way to the studio today, even though I've been here many times and had to do all these things. And, you know, where's the Starbucks? That was critically important this morning. So you have to take in all this data and pick what is the most important thing for me to focus on 1,000 times an hour. And this is what life is like. We have to do the same thing in our lives. And for folks with ADHD, that is hard. It's literally a problem driving, as well as a figurative example of what it's like to struggle in the decision making.
That's literally a brain thing. That's executive function, right?
Yes. And so if I structure you through driving, if I say to you, as I did with my daughter in the driving era, if I say, okay, I want you to turn the wheel left 1 degree, do that right now. You must activate your turn signal. And I say this very sternly, you know, that does not a good driver make. Because the minute I leave, then she runs into somebody, you know. So they have to become able to pay attention in the best manner. And believe me, I don't get in the car when my daughter's not on stimulant medication. Much better. She doesn't get in the car when she's not on stimulant medication.
Kim and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Ann. I want to thank you for this program because it's really been eye-opening. I have a grandson who's 9, almost 10. From an early age, he never made eye contact. He was obsessive about counting, and he could not answer a question. He'd just repeat your questions back to him. Mm-hmm. But then when he started in daycare, my son kept him in preschool for 2 years because he was slowly advancing. But he was diagnosed before kindergarten as being ADHD and high spectrum autistic. He is brilliant at math. He's brilliant at reading and spelling, but conversation was his main issue. Mm-hmm. And projecting, like, he could read anything.
Okay.
Large words, small words, but he couldn't tell you what the story was about. He knew what it was about, but he couldn't tell you.
So
he is on medication. He's on the second type of medication. He has been amazing as far as his accomplishment. My son is, I've never known a child who was, he had a horrible sleep pattern from the time he was an infant. He did not sleep well at night. He still doesn't. He'll stay up to 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning and then get up at 7 for school. When he was in preschool, he would doze off, but now they keep him interested.
Kim, I do not want to rush you, but I'm just wondering if there's other people.
Is autism frequently associated with ADHD?
Okay.
Or vice versa.
Okay, thank you.
So the answer is yes. And until the DSM-5, we weren't allowed to diagnose both, which is just makes
no sense.
The DSM-5,
you've made a couple references. I know what it is, but I can't tell you.
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 5, which is how
stuff.
We diagnose people in the biz. And it has its limitations. But one of the things they changed was allowing us to do those as dual diagnoses. Not only was that wise, but it was necessary because most folks, and I can't give you percentage, but most folks who have autism will also have symptoms of ADHD. And you describe exactly what our experience has been in treating them. However, it's a little tricky with medication management because that can push the symptoms of irritability in the autistic folks. So once again, hopping by your primary care's drive-through and grabbing some stimulants to give to your autistic child is probably not the way to fly on that situation. So lovely story.
Yeah.
See it every day. We treat a lot of those cases.
Yeah, Kim, thank you so much for listening and thanks for that call. I appreciate it. We have an email from Andrew. He said, I was diagnosed with ADHD at around 5. I recall taking a long cognitive test for a diagnosis. At 29, I have been on medication for most of my life. Do you find that as people mature, their symptoms decrease? Love the program and the conversation.
Yeah, great question. Mm-hmm. So the answer is ask me every year on this date and we will have a different answer. It has changed. There have been different views of this. At one point, it was thought that you grew out of ADHD. That is generally not true, but I have seen people who may have. We need to see brain scans of people who were teens with ADHD and later tested as adults, and that is not a large enough sample yet to know, but there is some movement in getting that research done. Another theory was that once you get out of school, it's not as necessary to learn, so you don't need medicine, so you think you don't have ADHD. Maybe. My experience has been in general that it just does not tend to go away, and perhaps, this is a Wes-ism, perhaps it is that you didn't have ADHD if it's gone away as an adult. But it may also be that you are, you know, done with the critical learning process and you know what you're doing and you don't need it. So that said, we have a lot of adults just like this individual who we will continue to see for years and years and swear by medication. And honestly, I probably should throw in, one of the things we talk about in the book is everybody who needs to be on these medicines are going to have a love-hate relationship with them. People who love being on these medicines, I always am a little curious as to whether they ought to be on them. Everybody else feels they are critically important and also struggles with the side effects that come with them.
Let's see. Laura in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Laura.
With her doggy.
With your dog.
One second. Hi.
I think the doggy has ADD.
I had a dog. My dog, excuse me.
Yeah.
I would like to comment on ADD and women, females. I had it my whole life, was only diagnosed as an adult. It was missed because I got good grades.
Hey, right. Laura, I hate to interrupt you. Laura, could you pull your mouth away from the phone?
Okay.
We're getting a lot of static.
Can you hear it better?
No.
Better now?
Barely, but go ahead.
Hold on.
I think it's the connection.
It's a terrible connection. Okay, I'm just gonna put Laura on hold. We're gonna get that under control.
And I know where she's headed there. I think it's a good point. For women with ADHD, there is probably under diagnosis because they do not show the symptoms we're used to seeing. And because in our society, that thing I said earlier about women being more driven, and most of my clients are women, so I see this quite a lot, then they will do well in spite of the impairment from ADHD. And sometimes they just have to work. You know, I have kids in my office weeping because they work on schoolwork 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. And it's very painful because the amount of work they put in does not reflect their intellectual capability. So just looking at, and the schools will do this, just look at someone's grades doesn't tell us whether they have ADHD or not. And that's particularly prevalent for women.
We had an earlier caller on. They hung up, but they asked a question about getting an individual education plan and how hard it is. And now we have Susan in Omaha. I think you're kind of on the same track, Susan. We're running out of time, so go ahead.
Well, the school seems so resistant to recognizing that this exists. My kids were all intelligent, but they weren't performing, and so the teachers didn't like them. When they finally got a diagnosis, I told a teacher about it, and she said, oh, yeah, I know all about it. My kid has it. And it's like, why didn't you tell us? You could have spared years of grief. Mm-hmm. And is the school responsible, you know, if they suggest that, you know, your kid might have something that, you know, and plus, you know, what these kids need is good teaching techniques, which benefit all kids anyway. So I don't understand.
There's a tricky relationship between schools and where they can cross the line in this regard, right, Wes?
So we have a whole other show here on how to do accommodations for folks with ADHD, and I think it would be a good show. Here's the super-duper fast answer, and you might want to email me if you want a little more elaboration on it. So the school is the difficulty of getting an IEP, an individual education plan under IDEA is the law, for an ADHD person is like getting the camel through the eye of the needle. Your better shot is to get a 504. And if you go into the school, all the principals listening are going to just scream here in about 1 second. If you go into the school and you say, we need an IEP, they actually have to test your child. And they will say, no, we don't do that. I don't know what you're talking about. They have to test your child. However, from a negotiating standpoint, if you say, or we need a 504 to see if that's going to work for what my child needs, they will probably say, let's do what's called a student improvement plan.
Which is the 504.
Well, there's another level below that.
Okay.
Student improvement plan is what they just sort of make up. And then a 504 is still somewhat legally binding, but it doesn't have some of the requirements of an IEP. For most ADD kids, if you can get them to do the 504 that they say they're going to do, that will take care of your needs in getting the child certain accommodations. And then we could spend a lot of time talking about what are the best accommodations for folks with ADHD. They aren't always the ones we think they are. But I would pursue something with the school, but getting them to the IEP level is just really hard.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. You know, we're just about out of time, Wes, but we did get another email, and I'm kind of curious about it. It's there's no name, but they say my nephew was diagnosed with ADHD when he was 13. It turned out he had type 1 diabetes. Have you heard of that?
Well, I know, and we do treat kids with diabetes. I don't know what the relationship is between diabetes and ADHD. That's an interesting question. That makes me want to look it up.
Okay. Sorry about that. But Wes Crenshaw, as always, you're right. I mean, we just scratched the surface.
This
but
always happens. We always run out of time, man.
It's really irritating.
Isn't there some way to get make time our friend? I don't know.
But we will have Wes back because we didn't even get to the pandemic and whatnot. So we will have you back as soon as we can.
All right.
Thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here as always.
That's Wes Crenshaw. He's a licensed psychologist and co-author of a new book. It's titled ADD and Zombies, Fearless Medication Management for ADD and ADHD. Thanks to everybody for all the great questions. I knew I could count on you. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.